From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. Now, before we jump into the show, a quick note. This will be the last podcast of Weekend All Things Considered. Instead of hearing stories from our show on this podcast, you can now hear them and other stories on NPR One, the new audio app that connects you to a stream of public radio news and stories curated for you. So, without further ado, here's our show. This episode, how torturing the architect of the 9/11 attack might save that terrorist from the death penalty.
It could affect what sentence ultimately a court will allow to be meted out.
Also, it's hard to have an informed debate on racial profiling when there isn't good data to work with.
You can't really say, well, your policy is having an adverse effect, because there's not a lot of data to compare it against.
How a little girl turned her disability into a superpower.
I had this awesome piece of technology on my truck that turned me into El Defo.
And here in Los Angeles, we'll take you to a memorial for the unclaimed dead.
Today, we as a community say once again they existed. And as a society, we say we honor you.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. The release this past week of the Senate report on abusive interrogation techniques used after 9/11 raised a lot of questions. Here's one you might not have considered. What does this report mean for the ongoing prosecution of Guantanamo Bay detainees? In 2003, Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch was assigned to Guantanamo as a prosecutor, but he quit after coming face-to-face with the abuse there. One of the men he was supposed to prosecute still hasn't had his day in court, Mohamedou Slahi.
He was subjected to forced nudity, to isolation, to changes in his temperature, both too hot and too cold. There were various ruses to have him believe that his mother and brother had been taken captive by the United States and would be harmed in the future. He was also subjected to physical abuse.
Stuart Couch left Guantanamo partly because that abuse offended him as a Christian, but also because those techniques may have ruined any chance to secure a conviction or a proper sentence for those detainees.
It makes the job of the prosecutor more difficult from two perspectives. First, if the methods constitute torture, then there are proscriptions under the law, specifically under the United Nations Convention Against Torture, on Article 15. Along with that is a problem with that kind of evidence from a perspective of credibility. The other legal problem for a prosecutor would be if the techniques to obtain the statements was so abhorrent that it could affect what sentence ultimately a court will allow to be meted out. That is the primary problem I see it going forward for the military commissions in Guantanamo.
Well, let's talk about the big trial at Guantanamo. This is the trial of the 9/11 defendants, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the attack. Those defense lawyers have been trying to get a hold of details about KSM, about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's torture in custody. Now it's on the public record. So how does that affect the case?
I evaluated the evidence against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and I wrote a memorandum on it. He can be prosecuted with evidence that was not derived from any of his interrogations. I was of the opinion he can be convicted based upon evidence that we knew about him, statements that he had made to others before he was captured and detained by the United States. The more difficult issue, as I see it, is assuming these individuals like KSM are convicted, and again assuming that they are subject to the death penalty, is a court, a reviewing court, or even up to the Supreme Court, is it going to allow for the fact that the United States is going to be able to execute an individual that presumably they tortured? Is it going to allow that? And that's what's hanging in the balance, and I think that that's the ultimate effect of this policy that was unforeseen when it was enacted.
Since you left the military commissions, they've been reformed, and the head prosecutor says they will not be using information derived from torture in making the case against the accused 9/11 conspirators. Do you think you could comfortably serve as a prosecutor in Guantanamo now? Have they fixed the problems that caused your moral and legal qualms?
While I still have my reservations about the effectiveness and the efficiency of the military commissions, from a perspective of would I be able to prosecute under the current set of rules, I believe I could. That being, I'm confident that all of the trial participants now are going to comply with the current rules that prohibit the use of evidence derived from torture or cruel treatment from being admitted at trial.
Stuart Couch is a retired lieutenant colonel who was a prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay. He's currently a civilian judge. Colonel Couch, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
One year ago, social psychologist Philip Atiba Goff started an unprecedented project to create a national database on racial profiling.
Since there are no national data on basic police behavior, like stops and use of force, this is going to be the first one that puts that together in any way that will allow us to start getting at the root causes of the disparities that we observe.
Goff is the co-founder and president of the Center for Policing Equity at UCLA. He started the research at the request of police chiefs around the country. In the last year, more than 50 police departments have signed on, and with recent police killings, public interest in this kind of information has grown stronger. It's a three-year project. He hopes that by next year, he'll have data on the largest urban law enforcement centers. The research could help inform the conversations and disputes that come up between police and communities.
Whenever communities feel as if they're being poorly treated, they say, you're arresting too many, you're stopping too many, you're using too much force. And law enforcement's most frequent retort is, we're responding to the situation on the ground. That's what the community needs. That's what the community asks for. And you can't really say, well, your policy is having an adverse effect because there's not a lot of data to compare it against. Well, what the database will allow us to do is compare things, policies, from one city to another city, from 10 cities to the other 10 cities, and get a sense of whether or not the policy in and of itself seems to be producing disparate outcomes. And if it is, then you have to take a look at the policy.
So can you talk about how you do that? Because in addition to this database, you are working with police departments, including in the Bay Area and St. Louis County, where there have been controversial police shootings. So that's the big question. What can be done to solve the problem?
Well, it depends on why we're brought in. I wish that we had some things we could take off the shelf and just say, here, take a couple of drops of these, call me in the morning, there should be less racism. But it doesn't quite work like that. But the general principle is this. We work backwards from objectionable or troubling behavior, try and find the roots of that to the best of our ability, and then create policies, trainings, and accountability that will reduce those kinds of behaviors. So, for example, if we see that there's a large disparity in stops, a racial disparity in stops, that does not indicate in any way that law enforcement are to blame for those disparities. But it sure as heck means that if we got a big red flag, we want to do something about it. So we start at the disparity, and then we say, what are the things that we know cause it? And the things that do belong to law enforcement, if it's law enforcement attitudes, if it's law enforcement policies that are contributing to a racial disparity in police behavior, well, we want to fix that. And in one place, it'll be about hiring. In another place, it'll be about stops and another use of force. And some places will combine them all together.
You know, Philip, there are going to be people listening to this conversation who think we're starting from a faulty premise here, that if you fly right, if you obey the law, you don't have to worry about being profiled. It's not an issue in that way. What would you say?
Yeah, I get that. I have heard that. I see it. I hear it from law enforcement. I hear it from folks in the communities. It's just not true. It might have been true for you in your life. For you who never got drunk before it was legal, who never drove too fast, never got into any mischief because you thought it was a good idea when you were too young to know better. But the vast majority of human beings are not that way. And the vast majority of human beings get to continue making youthful mistakes, making some mistakes well into adulthood, without having to worry that the rest of their lives are going to be marked by criminality and incarceration, and possibly even by death at the hands of the state. So you can say in one case they should have complied. In one case they shouldn't have been selling this. They shouldn't have been buying that. But the point is not that the person was perfect. The point is they wouldn't have been treated that way if they were from a different community or they looked a different way. And the statistics on it are overwhelming. So we should stop focusing on just the individual case, and we should begin expanding to, do we want the way that our criminal justice system looks to be reflective of our values, or do we want it to look how it does right now?
Philip Atiba Goff is the co-founder and president of the Center for Policing Equity at the University of California, Los Angeles. Philip, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We turn now from profiling to a project that aims to break down the misconceptions about black men in America. It's a short film called Hashtag Black Men Dream.
When did you become a black man?
The day I realized I need to stand up for myself.
In the film, nine men sit and answer basic yet piercing questions, like what makes you sad?
My mom refusing to accept me despite her brother being gay and her other son being gay. That makes me sad. The idea of having to give her up, that makes me sad.
It makes me sad. Being alone, or feeling alone, or feeling like there's no one that is in this world that really truly cares.
There are about a dozen more questions. Do you cry? How are you perceived by other black men? What's a nightmare you remember? A 25-year-old Philadelphia-based artist named Shykeith Cathy, he just goes by Shykeith, is the man behind it. All of his work, photography, sculpture, art installations, focuses on the perceptions of black men in America. You might think the film was made in response to the current debate around police use of deadly force, but Shykeith says the inspiration actually came 2 years ago.
I posted a status on Facebook that said, "What do black men run from?"
He was expecting answers that revolved around misconceptions of black manhood. Instead, he got a lot of negative stereotypes.
Mostly from African-American men and women. They were writing, "Black men run from the police, black men run from love, black men run from child support."
Shykeith set out to develop a project that would showcase a different side of black manhood. The film, Hashtag Black Men Dream, was born out of that. It's shot in black and white. All nine of the subjects are turned away from the camera. We never see their faces. Many are shirtless or naked.
I wanted to expose what it is like to be dressed in assumptions before even opening your mouth to say hello.
Shykeith says most of the men were strangers.
It was almost like a therapy session. The men, they would say, you know, "I haven't been able to express like this in so long," and it feels like a weight was lifted off my shoulder.
Wow. And it is that old Freudian analysis technique where the person has their back to the analyst.
Turn your back, yeah.
To get to that point, though, I mean, you had to have established some deep trust with these men. How did you get there? How did you get them to go along with it?
Honestly, I just asked, you know, huh. And that was the point. These questions, as simple as they are, do you cry? What makes you happy? What makes you sad? They aren't discussed.
When has your father taught you about expressing your emotions and when?
Nothing and never.
I couldn't remember a time when someone asked me, you know, how do you feel? And I think it's just assumed that I'm angry. Mm-hmm. As a black man, it's assumed that, you know, I don't possess these feelings that are a part of my humanity.
You feature a quote from the great Ralph Ellison novel, Invisible Yes. Man. And obviously that's about being a black man in America and having that kind of invisibility he talks about. And it's mm-hmm. just amazing in this film that by almost taking these guys' identities away, by taking their faces from us, you really reveal them.
Exactly. Growing up, I was ostracized from other black boys who felt I didn't fit into their ideal images of black manhood. My work is a reflection of that internal battle all black men have to face when you're not necessarily seeing things in black and white, but rather in gray. And, you know, like Ralph Ellison, I totally stress the importance of projecting more individual voices and differences in the black male community.
So you've been working on this film for years, but it's coming out at a time with, you know, these police killings of black men in Ferguson and Staten Island. It just seems particularly well-timed in a poignant way.
The timeliness of the work that I'm creating, it's all mere coincidence, you know, but I don't look at what's happening now as situational. You know what I mean? It's not trendy. It's not something that just began. Mm-hmm. It's something that has been ongoing in this country for a very long time.
Shykeith, where do you want the conversation to go from here?
I really want it to go towards just focusing on better engagement within the black community, especially amongst Black men, we can be different. We can be ourselves. We can respect individuality within our own community. As we project that, I think the community at large will understand more what it exactly is to be a Black man. Overall, there'll be a healing.
Shai Keith is a multidisciplinary artist based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His film is called #BlackMenDream. We'll have a link on our website, npr.org. Shai Keith, good speaking with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you cry?
Yes, often.
Today is an exciting day for pro football fans. There are only 3 weeks left in the regular season, but there are tons of teams still in contention for the playoffs. If that's not exciting enough for you, maybe try NFL Red Zone. For the uninitiated, the Red Zone is that area inside the 20-yard line where scoring happens most often. And NFL Red Zone is all about the scoring. For 7 hours straight, every football Sunday, they show you every single score from every single game as it happens, which sometimes involves multiple games on screen at the same time. Sound crazy? We sent our producer Becky Sullivan to spend a day behind the scenes and see just how chaotic it can be.
It's 7:15 a.m. Pacific time at the NFL Network offices in Culver City, here in the Los Angeles area. The sun's just risen. It's a little chilly outside. Inside, everyone's looking sleepy, dressed in hoodies, holding coffee. That is, everyone except Scott Hansen. Hansen is the host of the NFL Red Zone. Boyish, blonde, a big smile full of pearly whites. Right now, he is the very picture of vitality.
Well, see, I woke up about 5 a.m., and I stayed up last night until about, I don't know, 11 or maybe close to midnight.
His energy lasts unabated all day, and it has to. Hosting Red Zone sounds exhausting.
9 games will kick off at 1 o'clock Eastern. 4 more games will kick off in the 4 o'clock Eastern hour. We show every touchdown from every game, no commercials. It is a roller coaster ride.
The morning meeting starts at 8 a.m. Hansen has this huge stack of papers packed with rosters and statistics and streaks and records.
Jets and Vikings.
One by one, the production team goes through each of the 13 games, talking out potential storylines. Players to watch, narratives to highlight, that kind of thing.
So the Jets have attempted 45 passes that have gone 20 yards in the air. You know, deep shots, basically. They have 6 completions on those 45 attempts and 8 interceptions.
Ooh.
So the other team has caught it more than they have when they throw it 20 yards in the air.
Hansen and the crew are practiced at this by now. The NFL Network started Red Zone just over 5 years ago, modeled after a similar show on DirecTV that's only available to their subscribers. Both channels have millions of viewers. When Scott Hansen was in the audition process for this job, he watched a few tapes of DirecTV's version. He's friends with their host.
And I watched it, and I called him up, and I asked the embarrassing first question that everybody asks me is, when do you get a bathroom break during the 7 hours?
The answer? Well, sometimes you don't get one. So right before the show is about to go on air, he's giving a quick tour of the studio to some visitors when his stage manager interrupts him.
Up here, we'll have the scores of all 9 games. It's
Scott,
the matchup board right now.
Yep.
I need to excuse myself for a moment because I get my last bathroom break of the day right now. I'll be right back.
It's actually kind of a shock to walk into the studio. It's painted a vivid bright green. There's a silver podium in the middle, and that's it. On air, the rest of the studio is computer-generated, even the floor.
20.
Except for Hansen and his stage manager, it's totally silent in here.
Come to VO. 10 seconds.
And he's off.
4 fingers in the air as the regular season hits its final quarter.
And Red Zone is on the air.
End the Steelers' division title hopes. The Colts with a chance.
Barely a minute goes by before the first touchdown of the day.
Yep. Pick 6, first play of the game.
First snap.
Oh, wow.
They weren't showing that game live, so the crew has to roll it back on a replay machine, get the transition effect ready, get the timing just right. Then just 16 seconds later, it's on.
Check out the first play from scrimmage in the Jets-Vikings game.
And then it's back to silence in the studio. The chaos is in the control room, just on the other side of 2 soundproof doors.
Stand by with this flag. We're going to update Megatron's touchdown. Stand by. Game 3 update yellow.
Game 3 yellow update.
That's the producer, Brian Nettles. He's making decisions about what to show these first few hours. It's very dark in here. The only light comes from the dozens the dozens of TV monitors. There's one for each game, each replay, each graphic. I count 59, and that doesn't even include their computers.
Okay, I need to get ready for 5-3, and then bring in Detroit.
The live games are on the numbered feeds. Then there are 4 replay banks named after colors: steel, bronze, yellow, and green.
Roll yellow effect, pose, go.
There's a director, an engineer, and 7 other guys just keeping an eye on the games, the replays, looking up statistics, double-checking the rules. If that sounds like a lot of things to balance, it is. And sometimes it comes crashing down. About an hour into the broadcast, one of the replay feeds started rewinding, live on the air. But in a couple seconds, they fixed it, and Scott Hansen doesn't bat an eyelash.
And an update in the Browns and Colts game. Brian Hoyer on 3rd and 4, and...
And you know, given the craziness of the control room, the 9 games they're juggling, the constant switching, the fact that I only saw one mistake might be the most impressive thing of all. 7 exhausting hours later, there's just one thing left to do. Make the signature 10-minute-long montage of all the day's touchdowns, one after another.
And the catch is made by Benjamin for a Carolina touchdown.
For the touchdown! Touchdown!
And that's the allure of Red Zone. If you'd been watching all day, you'd have seen all 64 of them already. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Fans of director Paul Thomas Anderson, and they're a devoted bunch, sometimes have to be patient waiting for his next feature. But when they arrive, Anderson delivers in a big way. Think of the splash he made with Magnolia in 1999, or Boogie Nights, or There Will Be Blood. Epic films, taking on big ideas in big and original ways. For his latest film, another project that looks impossible on paper, adapting a book by the notoriously reclusive novelist Thomas Pynchon.
I need your help, Doc.
Doc Sportello is an L.A. private detective, the protagonist of the novel and now the film Inherent Vice.
I have an office now. That's like a day job and everything.
Joaquin Phoenix plays the pothead, hippie detective at the center of the 70s story. After Doc's ex-girlfriend shows up, he finds himself on the trail of what might be a massive conspiracy. Paul Thomas Anderson says he's a huge fan of Thomas Pynchon, and he got his hands on the book as soon as it came out.
Like when any of his new books come out, which is very rare, actually, you just buy the amount of time it's going to take, you know, from your spouse, from your family. You hang a do not disturb sign on the door, and you tuck into the book. And I remember thinking, I don't know how to do this, you know, but really thinking, I've got to figure out how to do it.
And so what was it about the story, the way that Pynchon told it, that grabbed you and made you think, I got to at least try to make this?
Well, it was the easy stuff, like a great central character, a great hero who has a good sense of humor, who has a great desire to do good.
This is our protagonist, the stoner detective,
Doc Sportello. Doc Sportello, who is sentimental, who is still shocked and surprised at all the bad that is happening around him to his people, the hippies, his country. And there was a great dynamic between this stoner hippie detective and this civil rights violating LAPD detective, Bigfoot.
And I want to talk about these characters a bit more because maybe it's easier than talking about the plot, which is kind of tricky.
Yeah.
Well, our protagonist, Doc Sportello, the stoner detective, what were you looking for in the actor that could bring this guy to life? Because he's quite a character.
He is quite a character, and Joaquin is deeply funny. I know people wouldn't expect they think he's weird or whatever, or he's a serious, brooding actor, but that's so far from the truth.
He can communicate this humor in this really understated kind of way, just with a slight gesture.
Yeah, he does. He's got a lot of good face ingredients going on.
Yeah,
you know, he has impulse control problems, you know, sometimes that any good detective should probably keep his cards very close to his vest and sort of take information in and not reveal that it's important or not. Doc Sportello has a hard time not reacting in gigantic, over-the-top ways to new pieces of information that come his way.
And then his foil, Bigfoot Bjornsson, the hippie-hating cop. Josh Brolin, on his own, makes this worth the price of admission. How did you work with him in creating Bigfoot?
Well, when you have a book as your Bible that you're going back to, that's the work, constantly underlining it, constantly looking at different things that Pynchon has written here and there. And you hope to kind of catch a line that will really kind of reverberate. There was a line about Bigfoot's air of possessed melancholy, which that says it all. You know, that kind of can instantly do away with any, you know, sort of unnecessary actor-director dialogue that you have between yourself. You just take a line like that and you go, that's something to play.
Okay, well, so far we have murder and kidnapping. We can work in pirates if it would make you more comfortable. Either way, it's high profile.
Yeah, but given your history of harassment with my client, this will never make it to trial.
No, I think we could probably take this all the way to trial, but with our luck, you know, the jury pool will be 99% hippie.
When it comes to adapting the book, first off, I can't imagine that Thomas Pynchon would let just anybody adapt one of his books. Was it difficult getting the rights?
It was very straightforward. It was represented by an agent. The request was accepted, and it was all very straightforward. But that's not to say that it wasn't lost on me that we were the first people to do this, to adapt a Pynchon novel. So I took that as a vote of confidence in our direction.
And then I've got to imagine adapting a Thomas Pynchon novel is tough. How did you approach that?
I approached it in the most straightforward but laborious way I could come up with. I transcribed the dialogue, you know, write it out like a script. Doc says this, Shasta says this, Doc says this, and on and on and on. And there were multiple times when I thought, why don't I just call the publisher and get a PDF and cut and paste this on the computer? But there was something about typing it out again that made me, it made me get to know the book, you know, really deeply. It was funny just how simple it all started to seem at a certain point, you know, because people talk about this movie as being convoluted and complicated, and there's all that, but that's all just sort of window dressing to keep it entertaining and fun, because underneath it, the points do connect, and they're actually not that complicated.
Well, we have this cartoon version of Pynchon, you know, the recluse, and I say cartoon, he's actually been on The Simpsons, funnily enough. Did you have any contact with him? Did you work with him at all? Talk to him as you're bringing this together?
No. You know, I mean, maybe, you know, but maybe I don't know. You know, it's like there's famous stories.
What does that mean?
You know, well, there's a famous story of B. Traven was another writer who nobody knew who he was and nobody had seen him. And he wrote the book that The Treasure of Sierra Madre is based on. And the rumor goes that, like, you know, down in Mexico, John Huston would get pages mysteriously slipped under his door by, you know, by who? Maybe from B. Traven, you know. Or that they'd be shooting on some street in Mexico and they'd look over and see some mysterious man in a hat and sunglasses watching from a distance. That was that B. Traven? Who knows? So,
wait, are you Thomas Pynchon?
Exactly. Are you Thomas Pynchon? Exactly right. I mean, obviously, he's a flesh and blood person who exists, who wrote a book, you know. But he spent a lot of his life or his entire professional career deciding, I don't want to be a part of whatever the spotlight is. And that's groovy with me. I think that's a good way to go.
Director Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, based on the Thomas Pynchon novel, is Inherent Vice. It's out right now in New York and Los Angeles and comes out nationwide next month. Paul Thomas Anderson, thank you so much. Real fun speaking with you.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about career triumphs, big and small. Los Angeles Times reporter Ruben Vives won a Pulitzer Prize for his investigation into government corruption in the California town of Bell. It led to multiple convictions and big changes to government throughout the state. But before the Pulitzer, Vives was living in this country illegally, and he had no idea.
I was born in a small town called Mazatenango in Guatemala. When I was a year old, my parents decided to leave me behind, and they decided to come to the United States of America. My grandmother raised me for a few years, and then when I was five, I was brought to the U.S. This whole entire time up to starting my freshman year in high school, I had no idea that I was undocumented, all of my documentation had expired. We had an immigration lawyer that we were paying to get this documentation going for me, and it was an attorney just basically scamming my mother for money and not really doing any of the work. My mother was working as a housekeeper for Sean Hubler. She was a columnist for the LA Times. It wasn't until when I was 17 years old that my mother finally said, you know, you're undocumented, you're not here in this country legally. And she told Sean Hubler that, and at the time, Sean knew an immigration lawyer who she had done a story and had befriended and went to him for help, and he immediately started helping us. If it wasn't for Sean Hubler and the immigration lawyer that she knew, I probably wouldn't be sitting here. To this day, I wonder whether I would have acted differently had my mother or my parents told me early on, like, you're undocumented, so you have to be careful what you do. And instead, I was like this kid running around with a skateboard, you know, cops pulling us over and saying, like, you can't be skateboarding here. And, you know, this whole time, I just like, oh, my God, I could have got deported. Sean Hubler had asked me, you know, would you like to work at the LA Times, do a summer gig there? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. I started as an editorial assistant, but I got to see all of the great writers. So I started tagging along with them, and just the compassion that went behind reporting their stories and the passion to get the truth, it affected me a lot. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to make a difference like these reporters. It was my big break. The idea that my name is on that byline of that story, it means a lot to me, because I'm leaving my footprint behind, and sort of this is what I set out to do, just make something out of myself for the sake of my mother, who worked really hard to get me here, you know, for the people who took a chance on me, like Sean Hubler and the paper, the LA Times itself. Every time I try to push myself to do the best that I can for the sake of these people. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have had that big break.
That's LA Times reporter Ruben Vivas. You don't have to win a Pulitzer to have a big break. Email us your story at mybigbreak@npr.org, and we might just put you on the air. Karen DeWisha, professor of political science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, spent the last 5 years investigating how Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, came to control so much of that country's wealth. Her new book is Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Karen DeWisha, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So when you call Russia a kleptocracy, can you explain what you mean?
Sure. So what I mean is that Putin has created a system where he nationalizes the risk and privatizes the reward. So when we think about the Sochi Olympics, for example, it's well known that they cost about $50 billion, and most of those contracts were awarded as no-bid contracts to people close to him, and billions were made by them. Another example would be the collaboration of Putin's closest circle in the establishment and funding of Bank Rossiya, a bank that has emerged as one of Russia's top 10 banks that receives a lot of government state budgeting, but it's a private bank. So here you have a case where the money to fund comes from the state and the profit goes to friends of the current president.
And the roots of Putin's rise, as you describe it, they go all the way back to the last days of the Soviet Union. Can you talk about what was happening then with the KGB and with Putin?
Right. So what happened was the KGB and conservatives in the Communist Party got quite worried that Gorbachev, who is a reformist, might install a multi-party system, as had emerged in Eastern Europe. And that would mean that they wouldn't get access to state funds. So they decided preemptively just to take them. And then, having done that and put the money, you know, buried the money deep, there was a coup attempt against Gorbachev, and he and Yeltsin banned the Communist Party. So the KGB suddenly knew the bank accounts for all of this money, but there was no oversight. So they just did what comes naturally.
And what you write about seems like it involves KGB, the former KGB, and Russian criminal activity. Are they all connected?
Right. They are connected. What we might expect in a Western country is that the ruling authorities would suppress the mafia. But it doesn't happen even in the United States. So there have been periods even in the United States where certain cities come under the influence more than others of mafia activity. But in Russia, what happened was that the central state came under the influence, significant influence of mafia activity. And sometimes some groups were favored who were willing to enforce contracts, run off-books operations, and take money out of the country. And so, you know, money was flooding out of Russia, both mafia money and KGB money.
So it seemed like this process, in a way, the status quo was working very well for Vladimir Putin and his friends. But since what's happened in the Ukraine, Russia's actions in Ukraine, the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, doesn't that complicate the status quo? How do you see what's happening, these latest aggressions fitting in with Putin's overall economic strategy?
I don't think that there's any way that he could have predicted that there would be sanctions of the type that have been imposed. You know, it was a military exercise that he engaged in. He probably expected a military response. That hasn't happened. So when these sanctions came down, he was extremely surprised and has encouraged the people who've been sanctioned around him to take the case to court and to fight back in the legal arena. So we'll see if they do pursue that. I think they certainly will in Europe.
And speaking of court, but before I let you go, I need to ask you, this book, your book was originally going to be published by Cambridge University Press in Britain. And I understand that they dropped it because they were concerned. I know Britain has different libel laws than we have here in the U.S.
Right. So what happened in Britain is that their libel laws are such that only if it's proven in a British court as being true can you say that a charge is true. So the fact that, you know, I've written a very academic book with thousands of footnotes, fulfilling more than the necessary academic standards in Britain, the book could be challenged in court. And friends of Putin have shown themselves willing to defend the regime by taking on lots of people in British courts.
And not to put too fine a point on it, but these would be people with fairly deep pockets.
Yeah. Yeah, infinitely deep pockets, one imagines.
Karen DeWeese's new book is Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Karen, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure, Arun.
People in Los Angeles are used to hearing helicopters overhead, police, movie shoots, news, and this week, military operations.
Line up! The 3rd Floor, fire!
The 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit has been using downtown L.A. to train for urban warfare. They're practicing fighting in a city, dealing with local police, civilians, unfamiliar streets and alleys. The biggest exercise so far has been a mock raid at Dodgers Stadium, complete with air support, although they weren't using live ammunition. I called the unit's commander, Colonel Vance Cryer, who's managing the operation from a busy operations center in Monterey, California. He described the plan behind the Dodgers Stadium raid.
Well, this is part of a larger exercise that's called RUT, or Realistic Urban Training Exercise for the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit. In this particular situation, we were coming in to do a raid site on a suspected arms dealer who was working out of the stadium, on the side, producing IEDs and that type of thing.
The fake Dodger Stadium raid involved a lot of planning. About 100 Marines, plus local police, stadium security, and medical services. I asked Cryer why the effort was worth it, especially since the unit has sophisticated training facilities here in Southern California at Camp Pendleton.
So, you know, we're fairly confident that if the enemy invades Camp Pendleton, that we're going to win, right? So, we partner with the local communities, and we're an extension of those communities, and so they give us an opportunity, a unique opportunity to put the Marines into situations, into terrain that they are unfamiliar with, and we challenge their decision-making ability, and we get to work on the complexities of the legal, moral, and ethical aspects of today's complex environment.
And when you're doing the activities, you know, say in the city of Los Angeles, what kind of measures do you take to avoid spooking people so they don't think, oh my goodness, what's coming that the Marines have to protect us from?
This is a really, it's a very, very organized and well planned a year in advance with the community. The 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, my higher headquarters, they do all the training and equipping, and they have safety observers in place. They've got people, for example, in the tower with the FAA, riding with the police officers, with security at the stadium, and working with the managers there at the stadium. Medical response on alert, everything's in place to respond and or take care of and prevent accidents.
Colonel Vance Cryer is the commander of the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit out of Camp Pendleton. He's currently running urban combat training exercises across Southern California and here in Los Angeles. Colonel Cryer, thanks very much.
Hey, thank you very much. Have a great day.
For these last few weekends of the year, we're featuring interviews with authors whose books we missed, great books that didn't get much attention when they came out earlier this year. And right now, one of my absolute favorites, a mix of memoir, graphic novel, and children's book called El Defo. It's writer and artist Cece Bell's own story of growing up hearing impaired. As you can tell from the title, it's unsentimental and very funny. The people are drawn as rabbits, and it manages to be both cute and edgy at the same time. So how does the mild-mannered little girl Cece transform into the superhero El Defo? It all has to do with something called the phonic ear.
The phonic ear was a big, bulky hearing aid. I wore it strapped onto my chest, and I had cords with earpieces that went up to my ears. And this hearing aid worked with a teacher's microphone, and basically the microphone amplified my teacher's voice and made it really clear, really loud, just for me. And soon after I got outfitted with it, I discovered that not only was I hearing her wherever she was in the classroom, but I could hear her wherever she was in the entire school building. So I had a lot of power. And it was awesome.
And that's what in the book leads to the birth of El Defo, because Cece comes to see her deafness not as a disability.
Right, exactly. At home, it was more of a disability. And in my mind, it was, because I felt very embarrassed and self-conscious to be wearing all this equipment and to be different from everybody. But because the phonic ear kind of gave me these superpowers, just like Bruce Wayne has to wear all that technology on his belt
right.
and turns into Batman, I had this awesome piece of technology on my chest that turned me into El Defo, this great superhero.
You use the medium really marvelously to be able to convey to people, hearing people, what the experience is like how it's difficult to read lips and how words get distorted.
Right. This is the perfect medium for that because of the speech balloon. For example, if, as a lip reader, if I'm wearing my hearing aids and I'm looking right at you speaking, I understand every word you say because I've got some sound coming in and the visual clues from your lips. So in a graphic novel, that speech balloon would be understandable to everybody what you were saying in that balloon. But if I maybe had my hearing aids out and wasn't looking at you, your speech balloon would be empty because I wouldn't know what you were saying and I wouldn't hear what you were saying. And then if I had my hearing aids in and I'm not looking at you, I can hear your voice because of my hearing aids, but it's all garbled. And so the speech and the speech balloon would be garbled. So it's just the perfect visual way to show all the ways a hard of hearing or a deaf person might or might not be hearing.
When you see a character speaking, an expression on their face and that blank speech bubble,
right.
It really hits you in the gut.
Yeah. And it's so much better than if I were to write that longhand, well, then someone said something, I think, and da-da-da-da-da-da, it would just take forever, where you instantly know, as soon as you see the empty speech bubble, that I'm not hearing.
Although it probably should be obvious to people listening that you read lips very well. We just make sure that my microphone here is not in your line of sight. And...
Right, right. You have a good voice, too, and that helps.
Thank you.
No mustaches or beards.
I want to make sure that we mentioned, though, that the book is not all focused in deaf issues. Like anybody who's ever been a kid, a little girl,
right.
There's stuff that's relatable and hilarious.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. I'm not a maudlin person, and one of my least favorite things are the movies that have some disabled person, and the violins come out, and it's all weepy, and you know, boo-hoo. That's not me. That's probably not most people with a disability, and there's a lot of funny things that happen with equipment, with misunderstanding people. There's so much humor in it. And I wanted people to come away and think, well, it's not all bad, you know.
I want to ask you, though, you've written other beautiful picture books and children's books before. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you turn to your own story earlier? What made you think of it now?
I don't think I was ready. Even though in the book, it seems like at the end of the book that I'm totally cool with it, with having trouble hearing. It took me much, much longer in my life to get to that point.
Hmm.
And actually writing this book and getting it out there and just going ahead and saying, hey, world, I can't hear very well. It was a big experience for me. And I just wasn't ready. I just wasn't quite ready to tell the world that I'm deaf. But suddenly I was ready, so then I did it. And I'm kind of glad I waited because I got a lot more experience as a storyteller with these other books. And I think that made me better ready to do it now.
Cece Bell's marvelous new book is called El Defo. Cece, really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
El Defo is one of the 250 or so books featured on NPR's Book Concierge, our guide to 2014's best reads. You can find out more of the books we love this year at npr.org/bestbooks. This past Wednesday, on a brilliant sunny day, a somber but beautiful ceremony at the LA County Cemetery. There's nothing special about memorial services in a big cemetery, but this one is unique because on this day, the cremated remains of more than 1,400 people are being buried. They died in 2011, but their remains were never claimed by anyone. After 3 years, the county goes ahead with a mass burial. Who are these people?
Some of them are nameless. Some of them are Jane and John Does. Some of them were victims of homicide. A lot of them, the vast majority, were a lot of older people and died in convalescent homes or nursing homes.
That's LA Times reporter John Schlois. Along with Malloy Moore, he digitized the paper records of the unclaimed for 2011 and looked at their stories. What are the most common reasons people might not be able to claim these bodies?
Money. Depending on whether it was handled by the coroner or the county, it can be $350 to $460 to claim those ashes.
And that's just the start, because then all the funeral costs, there's a lot of expenses involved, even after you pay that $350.
Right, yeah, depending on what you want to do. And even before that, you know, if the body was still at the coroner, you know, you'd have to pay the expense of a mortuary attendant to pick up that body and then, you know, start the process of embalming or cremation there.
Remains don't go unclaimed just for financial reasons. Sometimes there are family disputes or people just lose touch. And so they end up in the care of the county cemetery and this man.
I'm Albert Gaskin, LA County Cemetery Crematory. I've been with the county about 42 years.
For about 30 of those years, Albert Gaskin has cremated the bodies of the unclaimed dead. Gaskin works with one other man, Craig Garnett, in a small, one-story white building in the county cemetery in LA's Boyle Heights. In one room, there's a simple chapel with a concrete floor and 10 plain wooden pews. The crematorium is in back. There are three chambers in the black and metal cremation machine, and each one holds a single body at a time. It's 9 a.m. when we arrived, but the work had already started hours earlier.
We started this morning about 4 o'clock, so now we're cooling down.
The fires heat up to almost 1,600 degrees before they begin to cool down.
Completely off now.
Craig Garnett shovels and sweeps ash, making sure that each person's remains stay separated. Each one has a numbered metal tag to identify them. Garnett takes a long metal pole to pull the pan out from below. These are the remains for number 042206. After 4 hours, all that's left of the body are ash and bone fragments. Often medical implants made from plastic and metal remain. Gaskin removes those pieces and keeps them in a plastic crate.
Shoulder joint.
Yes, shoulder joint. This is part of the shoulder joint. This would fit on top of here, like here.
After the cremation, Gaskin places the remains in a plastic bag, which then go into small, oblong, brown plastic cases, roughly the size of a shoebox.
They're stored in here by year and number.
They're shelved and stored like a library collection until they're claimed or past the 3-year mark when they go into the mass grave. It's very detailed, precise work and emotionally intense. Gaskin and Garnett take great care to handle the bodies and remains with respect. And on top of that, Gaskin also deals with the people coming to claim their relatives. He often ends up counseling them through the process, taking on duties one would associate more with a personal physician or a priest.
You can't let it get next to you, but sometimes you feel their emotions. So you just said, are you all right? And you sit down and talk to them, pat them on the shoulder, and they like this. You just have to do the best you can to be a help to them.
And thanks to the digital database created by the LA Times, more relatives are coming forward to claim their loved ones. Again, John Schlois.
A woman had been looking for a relative, wasn't able to find this person, and actually emailed us because after our story ran, she found this person in our database and was able to go to the county and claim them.
Wow.
So it was pretty magical for her, and I felt really moved too because, you know, that was one person that...
And so she was able to retrieve these remains that otherwise would have gone into this mass grave.
That's right, yeah.
But the unclaimed, those who do end up in the mass grave, are not denied a dignified end. Which brings us back to the ceremony that took place this past week, as it has every year since 1896. It marks the burial of all the unclaimed men, women, and children who died in LA County in 2011. There are Jewish and Hindu prayers, the Lord's Prayer in multiple languages.
Our Father, who art in heaven, santificado sea tu nombre. Venga a nosotros.
뜻이 하늘에서 이루어지는 같이 땅에서도 이루어지니라.
Father Chris Ponet leads the ceremony. He's a Catholic priest but wears a stole bearing symbols from the world's major religions. Like an army chaplain, he has to minister to all faiths as well as non-believers.
They come to us as Larry 22s, Margaret 54s. Sometimes families are with them and some are not. But today we as a community and the great tradition of this county say once again they existed. And as a society, we say we honor you.
And even though these dead are unclaimed, there's a fairly big crowd here. County employees and media, along with others here just to pay their respects. Like Sam Judas. She had lost touch with her mother a long time ago. Only later she found out her mother had died and was buried here in 2002. This day seemed like the right time to visit.
I hadn't spoken to her in many years. And the first thing I did was check to see if she was still alive because I couldn't find her. I found the death certificate and called, and they confirmed she was here. And it took me a few years to accept it and then a few more years to be able to come. So that's why I'm here today.
I feel like it's the least that we could do is pay respects to these people.
Exactly.
They're people too.
So. That's Sam Judas's friend, Terry Levine.
This is my BFF, and our mother's names were Florence.
That's right.
She came to my mother's funeral, and
so she's here with me today.
Yeah.
As the ceremony comes to an end, Albert Gaskin, the cemetery caretaker, watches quietly, as he has for decades. Having brought the unclaimed of Los Angeles, thousands of men and women and children to their final resting place. Finally tonight, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will name a new crop of inductees any day now. Among those being considered, Sting, Bill Withers, The Smiths, Nine Inch Nails, Green Day, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Lou Reed, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Kraftwerk, Chic, NWA, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, The Marvelettes, The Spinners, and War. And if you think that's a long list, consider some of the iconic artists that still haven't made the cut. Check this out. Just some of the acts that haven't made it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame yet. If you're struggling to figure out who some of them were, run to our website for a list, nprmusic.org. For the week ending December 14th, 2014, that's the final podcast of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Becky Sullivan. Our intern is Chloe Prisinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo DeLaguila. Suzanne Levy is in for Mathoni Maturi as senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our executive producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, just not here. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. You can find our stories now on the NPR One app, and you can follow our show on Twitter at NPRWATC. I'm at ARUNRATH. Thanks to all of you who downloaded the podcast each weekend. See you on the airwaves.